You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear the story of a Czech painter who hid his work from the Nazis with help from his wife and find out how you can see the original pieces as well as their recreations on exhibit in Milwaukee. Now, President Biden is under pressure from many Democrats, including Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, to cancel up to $50,000 worth of debt for people still paying off student loans. Week, a group of 17 state attorneys general, including Josh Call of Wisconsin, wrote a letter to the president backing that effort. Biden says he supports forgiving up to $10,000 of student debt, but is resisting calls to raise that number. The country holds about $1.7 trillion collective dollars of student debt, but some researchers say that forgiving large amounts of that debt could actually benefit those who need help the least. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of forgiving some level of student loans, whether that's $10,000 or $50,000? What's been your experience paying back student loans? Do you favor across-the-board cuts if you're in favor of anything, or would you like to see a more targeted approach, or do you think people should pay back the loans they took out? And would you support making college more affordable on the front end? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sandy Baum is a non-resident senior fellow for the Center on Education, Data, and Policy at the Urban Institute and professor emerita of economics at Skidmore College. She's author of the book Student Debt, Rhetoric and Realities of Higher Education Financing. Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, when we look at the idea of across-the-board debt forgiveness, whether we're talking about $10,000 or $50,000 or the whole shebang, whatever, you've done a lot of research into who that helps the most. What kind of things do we see when we start to break down the numbers?
Well, the first thing is who's not helped by this. And who's not helped by this is anyone who didn't go to college. So if you didn't go to college because you didn't think you could afford it, you won't be helped. If you've already paid off your student loans, you won't be helped. So usually the conversation is in terms of among people with student debt, you know, who has the most debt and who would benefit most from large amounts of forgiveness. So we can talk about that question. It's important. It's important to note that about a third of borrowers who have student debt owe less than $10,000. A very, very small number of borrowers owe more than $50,000. It's maybe 20% of borrowers. They owe a huge share, maybe 60% of the loans. So you have a few people who went to graduate school. You cannot borrow more than $30,000 for most students and $50,000, $60,000 for some older students. You can't borrow more than that from the federal government for undergraduate education. So these large amounts of debt are for people who went to graduate school. Graduate school doesn't work out beautifully for everybody, but certainly people who went to graduate school have much higher earnings than typical taxpayers who made the loans to these people.
At a town hall event here in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee last week, President Biden was asked about the idea of forgiving up to $50,000 of student loan debt. He said he wouldn't do that. Here's a listen to his argument as to why.
It depends on whether or not you go to a private university or a public university. It depends on the idea that I say to a community, I'm going to forgive the debt, the billions of dollars of debt for people who have gone to Harvard and Yale and Penn and schools, my children. I went to a great school. I went to a state school. But is that going to be forgiven rather than use that money to provide for early education for young children who are come from disadvantaged circumstances?
Is there something to that argument that the higher amount of student loan debt that you forgive, $50,000 or more, that's going to people maybe who went to those elite expensive schools?
The issue is not so much where they went to school as it is who they are and what their circumstances are now. Student debt is disproportionately held by people in the top half of the income distribution. That's because higher education pays off very well for most people, and people who hold a lot of student debt went to college for a long time. They have a bachelor's degree, if not a graduate degree. So if what you want to do is help people who are struggling, Most of the people struggling to repay their loans are people who dropped out of college, people who borrow just a few thousand dollars. And forgiving up to $50,000 in student debt is helping lots of people who are simply doing much better than most of the people who are going to foot the bill for this payment. We do have in place, I must say, a policy that says if you have federal student loans, you don't have to pay more than you can afford. It's income based. Your payments are a function of your income. Right now, during the pandemic, you don't have to pay at all. But at all times, your payments are limited. And if you can't afford to pay over 20 years, your debt will be forgiven in the end. We already forgive debt for people who cannot afford the payments.
Is there a case to be made for not just payment limits or payment deferment, but actual loan forgiveness for that targeted group you were just talking about, the people who racked up some debt, didn't end up with that degree that's going to help them make money to pay it off?
There are certainly people who should have their debt forgiven. There are a lot of people, unfortunately, who are victims of fraud and abuse by their schools. We need to forgive their debt. They were misled into borrowing. There are people who, there are parents who were below the poverty level and we gave the parents loans and they can never afford to repay them. We should forgive those debts. If you dropped out of college with $5,000 of debt and you're working at the minimum wage, you're not going to be able to pay that off. We should not make you wait 20 years to get that debt forgiven. Yes, there certainly are groups of people whose debts should be forgiven quite quickly.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
Hi. So I fall into that category of some college, but not an actual degree. I had a heart attack while I was in college. I had $30,000 in debt, which tells you how far along I was, which has now ballooned to $50,000 in debt because I wasn't really able to work. So $50,000 would be great. Or if he wants to stick to $10,000, I would say make it so we can file bankruptcy on the rest or tie it to a ultra low interest.
Whoop, you're cutting out there, Tim. Sorry about that. That sounds like a very scary experience. Thank you for sharing that with us. The thought of controlling interest rates, being able to refinance, declare bankruptcy, and include student loan debt. Sandy, what do you think of those ideas that Tim floated there?
Well, the bankruptcy rules are a real problem, and particularly for private student loans, because if you go to the bank and borrow money put it on your credit card, you can declare bankruptcy and get it forgiven. But if it's for a student loan, then it's much more difficult to get it forgiven. So this borrower, I don't know anything about your income. Obviously, you, through no fault of your own, were unable to complete your degree. And if your debt is disproportionate to your income, as I gather it is, you need to be in an income-based repayment plan so that it will get forgiven. If you have a disability, a permanent disability, we should forgive your loans right now because you're never going to be able to pay them back. The idea of stretching the time period out is that for some people, incomes are low at the beginning after they leave college, and then they grow and they can afford to pay them back. But if we can already see that you're not able to work in an occupation that would allow you to pay off your loans, then yes, those are debts that should be forgiven. The caller also points to another problem, that loan amounts grow when people don't make payments. And we should limit how much the amount you owe can increase over time just because you're not able to afford the payments. That should be limited so that it wouldn't double over time.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Tony now in Wausau. Tony, hello.
Hello. I think that we should not forgive student loan debt because people made that choice and there were plenty of options available. I'm in the Wausau, Wisconsin area, and students here could have gone to the technical school and received a technical degree. They could also have joined the United States military and given themselves approximately $100,000 scholarships in 2 seconds by putting 3 or 4 years in the military, which is what I did. I graduated from college in 3.5 years without debt. My sons graduated from college in approximately the same amount of time without student loan debt. They made choices to work during school and were very conscious of making good choices while in school so that when they got out, they did not have debt.
Tony, thanks a lot for the call. And Sydney, there's a fairness argument and a responsibility argument that we hear in arguments against student loan debt. What do you think of what our caller had to say?
Well, I think both fairness and responsibility arguments are very important. Now, not everyone has lots of options. For many people, the only way they can go to college and get a degree is to incur debt. And for most of those people, that makes them better off than they would have been if they had not gone to college. And because they're better off, they can actually repay their loans. So it's right. We should not forgive everyone's loans. People used that money. We handed them the money. They used it. And for most of them, it was a very good investment. What we do need is insurance policies, because it doesn't work out for everyone. And if you borrowed the money and it just didn't work out for you, it shouldn't ruin your life. But it is absolutely true that there are people who worked their way through college and didn't borrow. There are people who have tried really hard to pay off their debts quickly. And to say to them, oh, sorry, you did that. If you hadn't, we'd hand you the money now. But, you know, sorry, you're out of luck. There are lots of inequities that would result if we just did a large blanket loan forgiveness. But it's not right that everybody has the option to get through college without borrowing. Many people do not.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Sandy Baum right now, senior fellow at the Urban Institute's Center on Education, Data, and Policy. We're looking at student debt in the United States and the idea of canceling some level of debt for borrowers. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of student loan debt cancellation? A $10,000 figure supported by President Biden, $50,000 figure other Democrats are backing, or do you want to see a more targeted approach, if anything, as opposed to across the board for everyone? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Sandy Baum, senior fellow at the Urban Institute, professor emerita of economics at Skidmore College, looking at the question of canceling student loan debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Isaiah is with us in Deerfield. Isaiah, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What you want to tell us about?
Well, I went to college. I went to UW-Milwaukee and graduated with a BFA in Arts and Technology around 2010. And I had, at the time, about $40,000-something in student loan. And I'm still paying on that today. And when I graduated, I didn't make a lot of money. Obviously, I went to art school, so maybe that has something to do with it. But I made about $16 an hour, which wasn't enough to pay for pretty much anything, and except for maybe an apartment. And so I went through a lot of jobs, and eventually I became a got into the skilled trades and became a union plumber, which is what I do right now. And now I'm able to make a lot of money to pay off my student debt and take care of my family, pay for my house and my car and all that stuff. And I guess I have mixed feelings about it, because it'd be nice if somebody forgave some of the money, which I still owe. I'm still paying on it. Even a portion of it, $10,000 or all of it, that would be awesome. Obviously, it would do a lot for my family to help out and make our lives better. But at the same time, I kind of feel like when you start paying off debt like that for people, you're kind of rewarding people for either not following through, or maybe just, you know, you don't really have to do as good of a job. Somebody's going to come and take care of it for you. And it's like, well, you know, I think a lot of people really need to step up to the plate and say, hey, I'm going to take care of this myself.
Isaiah, thanks a lot for the call. Sandy, a lot there. Mixed feelings on this and a personal experience. You know, a key word he mentioned, though, was 2010. And I think about, you know, we had this class of high school and college graduates hitting the job market in the depth of the Great Recession, another last year during the pandemic where maybe they did plan pretty well, but this really set back their early career path. The jobs they thought might have been available weren't. I don't know. How do you see that fitting into the student debt picture?
So the caller is right that there are, you know, arguments on both sides of this issue. It's interesting. Many, many people would say that if we could just give them $10,000, their lives would be better. And it might really be a good idea in this pandemic to give every household $10,000. But why would we exclude those households where no one went to college? That's what we're talking about. We're talking about saying, we know a lot of people are struggling now. If you're struggling, but you didn't go to college, sorry. If you're struggling, but you went to college and you borrowed money, we're going to help you out. And that's really not equitable. What about people with medical debt? I mean, I don't think anybody should have to borrow for healthcare, but many people have medical debt. And it's interesting there isn't a strong movement to forgive that debt. So we really need to think not only about stories of people who are having hardships and ways to mitigate those hardships, but about people in very different circumstances who are struggling and how we're going to equitably help people who need support.
Thanks, Isaiah, for that call. Before we go back to our callers, do you think we need, Sandy, to do more work on the front end to make college or some college options more affordable so that people don't have to take on huge amounts of debt? It may be in a gamble in a case where they might not be able to finish college and not get the benefit from it.
We absolutely need to do that. Right now, the federal grant program for low and moderate income students gives you a maximum of about $6,500 a year. There are calls to double that. If we doubled it, it would mean that many fewer people would have to take out big loans. Those are grants that are targeted at people based on their incomes. And we could double this for 10 or 20 years for the amount that people are talking on about spending on forgiving student debt. And forgiving that debt isn't going to send anybody else to college. It's just going to make life easier for people who already went to college.
Talking to Sandy Baum, non-resident senior fellow at the Urban Institute's Center on Education, Data, and Policy, talking about the idea of forgiving student loan debt. Back to your calls now. Buck is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Buck, hello.
Hey, how's it going? You know, this is a very, very complex idea, but we are, nothing's fair, and I don't think it's fair that we start forgiving debt for people who, you know, ran off and did college and then whatever. But if it's going to be done, I think it should be like all these PPP loans that the government's doing. Let's have it be done through a bank and have them look at your credit and have them look at your debt load that you currently have. And if you're just a bad spender and you've got a big house and fancy cars and you're asking for $50,000 in college debt to be erased, I don't think you really deserve it. If you truly fell on hard times and things aren't working for you, well, I think we need to help people out. But I think it needs to be done through a very strict process to make sure we're not just giving money to people who don't need it.
Buck, thanks a lot for the call. Sandy, what do you think of that idea, a process to confirm that people are, I guess, deserving of some level of forgiveness here?
So as I mentioned before, we do have in place income-driven repayment plans. So we verify your income. And then if you cannot afford to pay your student loans, you don't have to. That system makes a lot of sense. If you can afford the payments because your education paid off well, as it does for most people, you have to pay back the loans. You spent that money, you have to pay back the loans. But if it didn't work out for you, you don't have to pay them back. We need to improve the system. We need to make it work better for people. It's certainly far from perfect. But that idea, as the caller suggests, that we're going to forgive loans from people who really can't afford to pay them back, but for the many people who can afford it and are better off than the taxpayers who would end up paying the bills for them, those people should pay back the loans that they borrowed.
Thanks, Buck, for calling in. We heard from Susan on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Susan writes, "The future of our economy lies in the ranks of those with huge student debt. The cost of higher education has outflanked inflation, making it almost impossible for students seeking higher education not to go into huge debt. It's time to correct this imbalance." Susan raising the point of the future of the economy. There have been some studies, generally from supporters of debt forgiveness, saying that people with these high student loan debts aren't doing things like buying houses, buying cars, and it's a drag on the economy. What do you think of that argument, Sandy?
Well, first of all, the average debt of a bachelor's degree recipient who borrowed is equal to about a year of the difference in median earnings of high school graduates and college graduates. So even though you have that debt, if you're the typical college graduate, you could pay it back in a couple of years if you just lived at the standard of living you would have lived at as a high school graduate. Let me say that if we forgive student debt, if we forgave $10,000 in student debt, we wouldn't hand everybody $10,000 to go spend. It would be that over the months of the coming years when they would have been making payments, they'll have a couple hundred dollars extra every month. That is not a huge stimulus. And the fact is that people who went to college are more likely to buy houses than people who didn't because they have higher incomes.
Time for one more caller. Alex is with us in Green Bay. Alex, hello.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me. I think the huge part of the solution lies in the interest rates. So I went to college in a time where they significantly changed, and I ended up with higher rates. So even though I did get them reduced, if I looked at the $57,000 I graduated with, and if I made the payments and never missed a payment, I still would have ended up paying, I believe it was like $92,000 total. So that's a lot of money in interest. And when we can see 1% and 2% interest rates on everything right now, I think that's a huge solution that we can look at instead of a lump sum is what can we do with those interest rates, reducing them to little to nothing, and then still have that loan to pay back, but allow people to have more money to spend in the economy, assuming they get a good job or if they don't get a good job, and also reducing those payments short-term and long-term.
Alex, thanks for the call. We touched on interest rates a little bit earlier. Sandy, do you think that's an important part of the puzzle?
Well, it is in the sense that it would be great if the interest rates on the loans that you took were variable and changed with interest rates in the economy. But the fact is that monthly payments, if you're an income-based repayment, don't depend on the interest rate. They depend only on your income. So yes, we need to do something about the interest rates, but figure out how much you're paying on your mortgage and you'll see a similar problem. Charging interest is reasonable, but some of the interest rates on some of those older loans are really out of sync with the lower interest rates in the economy today.
Thanks for the call. Sandy, in our last 30 seconds, I mean, it's easy to say, you know, cancel $10,000 of student loan debt for everybody or 50 or all of it or whatever. Do you think we're missing some nuance in the political debate over this, though?
Well, I think that the people who hold student debt tend to be middle and upper middle class young people, and they are a powerful political force. And that it would be great if we paid as much attention to the serious problems of people who, because of the pandemic, cannot pay their rent, of people who can't pay their medical bills, of people who are having their utilities shut off. So we really need to think, we can't do everything. A lot of people have problems we need to solve. We should think hard about how we should spend taxpayer funds.
Sandy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sandy Baum is a non-resident senior fellow at the Urban Institute's Center on Education Data and Policy. She talked to us about student debt in the United States as some top Democrats are trying to get President Biden to back the idea of forgiving $50,000 of debt for borrowers. Coming up, we'll learn about a new exhibit at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee of art that was hidden from Nazis during World War II and now you can see in person or virtually here in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, going to the dentist isn't very fun to begin with, but it can get worse if you have to add in a long drive. We'll talk to a state senator about efforts to solve a problem of dental deserts around the state. Now, To Paint is to Live is the title of a new art exhibit that just opened a week ago at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee. The featured artist is Erich Lichtbau Leskly. He and his wife were imprisoned by the Nazis in a ghetto in what was then Czechoslovakia during World War II. His creations, they hid them in pieces. We talked to Molly Dubin, curator of the Jewish Museum Milwaukee, earlier today. Well, first, can you tell us a little more about the story of this painter?
Absolutely. We're excited to have just opened a very powerful exhibit called To Paint is to Live, the artwork of Erich Lichtbau Leskly. And Leskly was actually a little bit of a trained artist prior to being deported to Theresienstadt in 1942 by the Nazis, along with his wife, Elsa. But while he was there, he was put into kind of a design department, had access to materials that other prisoners wouldn't have had access to, and began clandestinely documenting life behind the ghetto walls.
And the survival of his art, Molly, is an amazing story in and of itself. And you're showing kind of both parts of it. How did he manage to preserve his creations in this incredibly difficult time?
That's a great question. His wife, Elsa, actually wound up hiding these small colored pencil creations and watercolor creations underneath the barrack where she was sleeping. At one point in 1944, a couple of other artists who were also clandestinely trying to document what was going on were caught. They were tortured and sent to Auschwitz. Of course, Eric and his wife, Elsa, were terrified of what their fate might be. So they wound up cutting up these pieces that he had created into fragments, burning away any titles or texts that would be incriminating or identify him as the creator, and hiding them within some crevices in the ghetto. And thankfully, they both survived the war. And when the Red Army liberated Theresienstadt in 1945, they were able to retrieve those fragments and put them back together. So what we have here in this exhibit is actually a pairing. It's a group that's on loan from the Holocaust Museum LA. It's about half of the permanent collection that they have of Lichwell Leslie's work. But what we have are the originals and then a larger, more detailed work created later in the early 70s when his family was living in Israel. So this is a revisiting of those memories, which again was probably, as it was the first time, a means of survival, literally of maintaining humanity and some type of, you know, sanity in such a surreal situation. You know, when he created them later, the ones he embarked upon in the early 70s, it was being forced to relive that, but also I'm sure a great catharsis in trying to come to terms with the experience.
Can you describe the art itself a little bit? Because it's vibrant and absurd and horrific all rolled into one. I don't know. Can you give some better words than I can?
It truly is. No, that's a very appropriate description. He had background in commercial design. He had gone to school for that. He had also done some apprenticing as a window designer. And so he is employing this technique that has a very cartoon quality. They are, you know, very caricature-esque, and they are very vibrant. And I think that that's incredibly fitting for a number of reasons. On the one hand, that was kind of the technique he was familiar with. But when you talk about the surreal situation and even trying in your wildest imagination to comprehend what was going on, that kind of juxtaposition of that cartoon approach is incredibly fitting. It's also fitting when you think about, you know, the greater context of social commentary cartoons or political cartoons, and certainly in terms of parallels to what we've been experiencing this past year. I mean, it was a social commentary on what the injustices were that were being perpetrated, but was also a truth-telling endeavor in exposing what the Nazis were doing.
And now, as you mentioned, we're in a strange situation now, especially for museums. Can you talk about how the couple different ways that people listening can go check out the art, both sides of the art, the originals and then the reproductions by the artist?
Well, we are thrilled to have actually reopened to the public after being closed for a second time since December 1st. So this is a great opportunity to come back in through our doors. We've taken many safety precautions to ensure people feel comfortable, everything from, you know, plexiglass barriers to sanitation stations to gloves to styluses, everything available so that you can come in, feel safe, and be in proximity to this artwork, which, you know, as you say, is incredibly, you know, fused with irony and satire, but, you know, a horrific narrative. And that combination is something that to be able to experience in person and share physical space with is something that really can't be replaced online, although we do have online virtual tours available. And all of our programs in connection with the exhibit are virtual for the next bit of time. But we're, of course, like everyone else, watching the trends, hoping COVID cases will go down and numbers of people that are feeling comfortable to go out and explore their local regional museums will be coming out.
Molly, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much for letting me share the story.
That was Molly Dubin, curator of the Jewish Museum in Milwaukee. We talked to her earlier today about a new exhibit called To Paint is to Live. It includes works done by the Czech Jewish painter Eric Lichtbau Leslie while living through Nazi imprisonment. That exhibit runs through May 30th. It can be seen in person or online. We should mention that WPR is a media sponsor of the exhibit. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here is WPR's Cynthia Woodland reflecting on one of her favorite stories where she visits a Madison kitchen to hear about a special holiday treat.
When Wisconsin Life kicked off 10 years ago, I got involved because I love recording people's stories in their own words. It's like opening a window into someone else's world. I especially like highlighting voices that are seldom heard. One of my favorite stories centered around a holiday food tradition common in African American families. In preparation for Thanksgiving, Madison's Carlotta Kelmis invited me into her kitchen to tell the story of food, family, and one of her favorite traditional desserts, that sweet, glorious, golden delight, peach cobbler.
I probably would start with maybe 3/4 cup of the peach reserve juice. And I'll probably just stir that till you get all the lumps out. I've been cooking since I can remember. I'm what's called a scratch cook, where I very rarely have recipes. It's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. What makes a good peach cobbler is a combination of sugar and the right spices and the right combination of butter. And that's pretty good. So what I'm doing now is just putting some flour on this board. Of course, everything is also about the crust. You got to have a crust that's nice and flaky, that has a good taste to it, that has a little crisp to it. The best dough recipe I have, I substitute my liquid. So instead of using water, I use orange juice. This pan here was my grandmother's pan. And my grandmother also, she did her a lot of canning. So I grew up eating peach preserves, canned peaches. And I remember some nights that was our dinner. We had fried salt pork, canned peaches, and homemade biscuits and syrup. And that was dinner. And we were very grateful. We didn't know we were poor, you know. Thanksgiving is a big holiday in my house. And I've had as many as 50 people at my house for Thanksgiving. Tables all over the place. Tables in the dining room, tables in the kitchen, table in the basement, people sitting at card tables or TV trays. So there's some things, traditional things that I always have. It's peach cobbler. No matter how I try not to make it, there people are, where's the peach cobbler? I tried one year and didn't have peach cobbler and said, I'm going to do apple pie instead. I end up throwing half the apple pie away. People just said, I'd rather have peach cobbler. Behind it is love. Behind it is history, legacy. I am what I am in the kitchen because of Cordelia Clark, my grandmother, and Lucille Verge Tucker, my mother. You know, they came through hard times. My mother had 11 children, so she had to know how to throw something together to make a meal to feed all of us. You know, the most important times happen around food. You know, it's an opportunity for people to come together and fellowship and talk about their day or what's going on in their life. And what better place to do it? Around a kitchen table or around a dining room table. So, happy Thanksgiving, everybody. So now that's a nice, perfect pie. And then I'll probably just take a little nutmeg.
That was Carlotta Kelmis sharing how she makes one of her family's favorite mouth-watering holiday dishes, peach cobbler. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Cynthia Woodland.
Coming up, how far do you have to drive for dental care? We'll talk about Wisconsin's dental desert problem and how a proposed bill aims to help fix it. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, our next guest says rural parts of the state need better and more access to dental care. The federal government has designated more than half of Wisconsin's counties as health professional shortage areas, meaning they don't have enough doctors or dentists. Wisconsin is home to just one dental school at Marquette University. Getting those graduates to move to these rural areas can be a challenge. Patrick Teston is a Republican state senator from Stevens Point. He's been working on legislation on dental deserts over the last couple of years. Senator Teston, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We'll talk about the scope of the problem you're trying to solve here. How big a problem are these dental deserts in the state?
This is a very big problem. As you led off with, over half of Wisconsin counties are considered dental deserts. And when you factor in all the major health systems that wrap around good oral health care, this is a problem that needs to be addressed. And it's not that we have a shortage of dentists here in the state of Wisconsin. It's where they're located. And so, unfortunately, in many rural parts of the state, in fact, all six counties that I represent are considered dental deserts. But with over half, that's a problem. And so when the number one reason why kids miss school is because of toothaches, that's a problem as well. And so we worked on legislation last session with the Marquette School of Dentistry that would create an incentive program to get students, once they graduate, to go practice in a rural community, because the likelihood that once they settle down there, there's a higher probability that they're going to set up their practice there for their career and hopefully provide a better quality of care and more access for people in underserved areas.
Yeah, talk a little more about how you are hoping to, and you're taking another crack at it, hoping to incentivize those new dental grads to hang up a shingle in a smaller town or in a rural area.
Yeah, so the way we had it set up in the last session in standalone legislation, and then what got incorporated into the budget that was slightly different, would provide a scholarship for students enrolled at the Marquette School of Dentistry that for every year that they practice or are in the scholarship program, they would have to give a number of years back to a total of 6 years of service in underserved areas. And the conversations I've had with some dentists, in fact, there's a dentist in my district who practices in the Tomah area, that when he graduated dental school back in the 80s, he always thought he would go to the Fox Valley or the Milwaukee area, but ended up setting up shop in Tomah, Wisconsin, a place he had never heard of before, and realized that he could have a very successful practice. And so that's what we want to try and incentivize. And while the provision that got incorporated into the state budget was unfortunately vetoed, we're trying to see if there's a way that we could do a better job to be more targeted to really focus on those counties that are most underserved and see if we can build upon it moving after the fact.
So can you talk about kind of the reality for your constituents right now? They're having to, what, drive hour, 2-3 hours to get even just that routine dental checkup?
Yeah, I mean, we have constituents, and I know I'm not alone here in the Capitol building, where constituents have had to drive upwards of 2, in some cases 3 hours just to see a dentist. In some counties, there may only be one provider in the entire county. And why that's a problem is that, well, if you're not getting your annual checkups, those issues can compound. And oftentimes we're talking about a population who may be on Medicaid, and then they end up in an emergency department or an emergency room where they have to have oral surgery done, which ends up being less cost efficient for the taxpayers of the state. So there's really a win-win situation here. We get to increase access for oral health care, and we also have the potential to drive down savings within our Medicaid program.
As you mentioned, this was ended up in the budget last time around, ended up getting vetoed by Governor Evers. Are you hopeful that there's going to be bipartisan support now if this is standalone again from your colleagues and then ultimately from the governor in this 2021 season?
That's my hope. I mean, last session we had 37 co-sponsors, members of both political parties, so it was a bipartisan bill. And obviously, the governor has every right to veto provisions within the state budget. That's his prerogative. Those are the powers afforded to him. But our hope is to make an even stronger case going into this session and even in this budget session. And that's why we haven't just taken a look at this particular legislation, but that's why I've worked with State Representative Todd Novak to provide more money going into our community health centers, where if we can get these extra funds allocated to the community health centers that do tremendous work in a lot of dental care, we could actually increase dental visits in the state of Wisconsin by 32,000 visits.
Talking to Patrick Teston, Republican state senator. He is working on legislation aimed at bringing dentists to rural communities in Wisconsin, dental deserts, where it's hard to find, in some cases, dental services. And Senator Teston, we've talked over the years about similar things you've worked on to make sure that attorneys are available in rural communities. mental health care, things like that. Is there a chicken or the egg problem? If I'm that new graduate, I want to go to a place, if I'm a dentist, where I can, you know, have a doctor nearby, a lawyer nearby. If we start to solve each piece of that problem, does it make these communities more attractive for all the other professionals to set up shop in?
Oh, absolutely. This is definitely not only a quality of life, but also an ability for us to highlight our rural areas of the state. We are blessed to live in such a gorgeous and diverse state where, especially in today's day and age, where many millennials who are beginning to set off on their own careers, they want to have a good work-life balance and may not necessarily want to have the hustle and bustle of a large city where the cost of living is oftentimes much higher than it is in rural communities. And so that's why you're seeing a wide array of approaches to help develop our rural communities, whether it's broadband expansion, trying to get other professionals to move into these communities, because we have a great story to sell. And we know that if we can get them there and they can set roots down, that the probability that they stay there increases dramatically.
So if you end up with the dentists and the other categories I just talked about, does that end up being an economic driver? Does it convince those, say, millennials that, hey, this is a place where I've got everything I need?
Yeah, I think it certainly does. And that's why we're going to continue to push for ideas that are a little outside the box that can provide those types of incentives, because we are fortunate to be in a state where financially we're in a good position and we can make some of these targeted investments that hopefully will have a ripple effect in areas of the state that have often been overlooked. And so that's my hope with a number of these provisions as we move forward again and working with my colleagues in the Rural Wisconsin Initiative to hopefully get good common sense bipartisan bills to the governor's desk that will get signed into law and hopefully be a talent attraction for rural areas of Wisconsin.
You mentioned broadband as being part of this, and that's, I got to say, a word I hear a lot from both parties in Wisconsin. It keeps being cited as, yeah, we're going to argue about all this other stuff. Broadband, maybe we can work together on. Do you think this is the year? I mean, there have been grants already in the past. Do you think this is the year and maybe the budget where there's a bigger and more committed investment to that rural broadband development?
I would certainly hope so, that there's an openness to do that. In the last two budgets that were signed in law, both by Governor Evers as well as Governor Walker, there were significant investments made in broadband. And if anything, in the wake of COVID-19, we have come to realize that broadband is more crucial than ever and that this really is part of our infrastructure as we conduct daily business via Zoom, using telehealth, and things of that nature. And so, you know, I think that's going to be an area of compromise. Now, whether we can get to the full $200 million that the governor has proposed remains to be seen, because we also want to make sure that we're just not throwing money at the wall. We want to make sure that we fund the need within the broadband expansion program housed at the Public Service Commission. And so we've been having conversations with stakeholders on ways to improve that, increase more access. And so I'm hopeful in some form or fashion we will continue to make investments in broadband expansion because it's desperately needed.
Are there other rural priorities in this big budget year that you're hoping make it through?
Yeah, I'd say some of the other areas that I'm interested in, and hopefully as we work with our colleagues on the Joint Finance Committee that we can take a look at, are things like rural economic development, things like workforce housing. We have a huge housing shortage in the state of Wisconsin, especially in rural areas. And so about all these great ideas that we have to get these professionals into rural communities, well, it's not going to do us any good if they don't have a house to move into when they get there. And so you're going to see a lot of provisions either within the budget or standalone bills that are going to kind of piece together a puzzle that is going to be used to for talent attraction and economic development in rural Wisconsin.
And Senator Tustin, bringing things back home to this this dental bill you're working on, what is the timeline? Is this going to stay standalone? Does it go into the budget? Where is this going to be in process? When are we going to get results here?
Yeah, we're still in discussions on how we may fine-tune it and try and tweak the legislation from last session to hopefully get some more co-sponsors and hopefully get more bipartisan support to make a case that if it gets to the governor's desk, either standalone or within the budget, that it will survive a veto pen. And so we're still kind of huddled together right now, and hopefully within the coming weeks we'll get something out there for co-sponsorship. But if this is an issue for any of the listeners out there who are maybe in a rural community right now as we speak, who are having a hard time getting connected with a dental provider, I would say contact your state representative, your state senator, and say, look, we need to increase dental access in underserved areas. And so anything that we can do to help, put this on legislators' radars, and that's going to help us make a stronger case to hopefully get this into law.
Senator Tustin, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Patrick Tustin is a Republican state senator from Stevens Point. He joined us to talk about the lack of dental care in many rural parts of the state and the proposed bill that could help alleviate the problem in the future. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Keeley Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Keeley and her guests look at Rush Limbaugh's impact on conservative politics here in the United States. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's The Week in Washington. We'll look at some of the top stories in national politics, including the first congressional hearing yesterday, looking back at the violent January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.